Okay, hello, 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 hello. Can you all hear me? Welcome to this colloquium on ending world poverty, which is the title of Robin Maris's new book. Robin's sitting on my right and your left, he's there. What we're going to do this evening, I should say I'm Will Hutton, I'm the editor-in-chief of The Observer. And what we're going to do this evening is we're going to get all six speakers to talk for between 4 and 5 minutes, and I plan to be quite ruthless about guillotining them at five, but warning them at four, that's where they've got to. And then it's going to be open up to debate, when you'll make, I hope, 30-second and one-minute points, questions. We'll take questions in clusters and get members of the panel to answer them, and then we'll give them all the last word at the end. And I guess we'll aim to finish, I was going to 8 o'clock. People feel comfortable with that? You all comfortable with 8 o'clock finish? Okay, we'll finish at 8 o'clock. If those who get bored can indicate, and we'll have a plebiscite at 5 to 8 if they want to bring...
Well, they could walk out.
Or you could walk out, as Claire says. All right, well, I'll introduce the panel to you very quickly. On my extreme right and your left is Dr. Lal Jeyawardena, who's the Sri Lankan High Commissioner and has been a prolific writer on debt issues and ran the UN Economic Development Commission for a period. Then there's the great Maris himself, whose book, Ending Poverty, is the proximate reason we're all gathered here tonight. Then next to me is Tim Gorringe, theologian, University of Exeter, again a prolific writer. His last theological book, he tells me, sold 2,000 in 3 weeks, which must be an all-time record for any book on theology at any moment in world history. On my left and your right is Claire Short. You need no more introduction from me about Claire. Then there's Mary Caldor. Those of you who are at the school should know Mary. She's the director of not the Programme for Global Governance, as it says on your little slip here, but actually the Programme for Global Civil Society, which is even more grandiose than the Global Governance. And then there's George Monbiot, and those of you who don't read The Guardian should know he's a brilliant columnist and has actually succeeded in doing what no one until he started writing had done, which was to really bring environmental issues and put them on the features page of the Guardian, make sure they're read, and then broaden the agenda out. Startling success, great campaigner, author, and a visiting professor at three universities, all of whom he goes to speak and lecture at, unlike me, who's not yet turned up, I think, more than once at any of them where I'm visiting professor. However, we'll draw a veil over that. They're all going to talk for 5 minutes. We're going to start off with Robin, and we're going to try and kind of bat this around. It's a kind of debate between wets and dries, between hard and soft heads, although I don't think either side of the debate would like that description of themselves. Except for Robin, who would.
Well, so who wants a soft head?
Well, but Claire, who wouldn't? We'll let the debate begin with Robin having his opening 5 minutes. Robin.
We've all got soft hearts.
1845. I'm going to start in a rather depressing way by saying what I mean by poverty. And the book that I've written and what I'm concerned about is about both relative and absolute deprivation. And when I speak of absolute poverty, I define it in the same way that the UN do when they talk about income poverty. It's very important to understand when you read these things how these definitions are actually got at by the UN. In the first world, the UN says a person is in poverty if they're trying to live on less than 15 American dollars a day. What I call the second world, the transitional economies, it's about $5 a day. And in the third world, it's $1 a day. And it's this number, the $1 a day, which is what most people are talking about when they speak of absolute poverty in the world. But there's a thing about these numbers. I'm sorry to be boring about this. It's not alive, is it? Can you hear me at the back without the microphone?
I bet you can. I think you should hold that. Just hold that like a rock and roll star.
I can do without you. In the it's very important to understand that these figures have what is to some economists a very technical aspect of them, which turns out to be highly political in its significance. They are based on what's called purchasing power parity calculations. So that when we speak of somebody, shall we say, in India, some unfortunate person attempting to live on less than a dollar a day, what we're speaking about is what one US dollar would buy today in America, not what it would buy in India, which it would be a lot more, of course, at the exchange rate in rupees. Similarly, when we speak of the $15 a day, this is, of course, what $15 would buy in the United States, and it is actually the official American federal government poverty line. That poverty line is applied by the UN to anywhere that it classes as being in the first world, even Ireland, for example, the effect of which is to give Ireland, on the statistics, an amazingly high-looking poverty rate. Now, 10% of people in the whole first world are below that $15 a day line, which is an amazingly high figure if you think about it, but it is 10%, it's not 30%, and it's not some magical huge number. In the transitional economies, it's very high, it's 20% who are below the $5 a day line, and that number has massively increased since the fall of communism because of the general disruption and the fall in the level of production in those countries. In the third world, there are 28% of people in the third world below that line. And that means that we're speaking about 1,350 million people below the $1 a day line in the world. And it is a dreadful statistic as far as I'm concerned. And I think you and I would completely agree that it's a moral outrage. Now, by relative deprivation, I mean, effectively, excessive inequality. It's not possible to say we're going to eliminate all relative deprivation. Well, it's possible, but it would mean that the whole world had the same income. Everybody in the world had the same income. And that is not, rightly or wrongly, on the agenda of the world at the moment. Now, I am speaking about these concepts in terms of people, not countries. But if we look at all the peoples of the world, there are two causes of general inequality, of relative deprivation. One is inequality within countries, the simple fact that in any first world country, for example, we know that there is an enormous amount of inequality, there's a range. And then there is inequality between countries. In other words, the average income difference in standard of living between, shall we say, the first and the third world. And in effect, at the moment, that difference is a factor of 10 to 1. The average per capita real income of first world people of all types is 10 times that of the average third world person. Again, when you make a statement like that, you've got to understand you're using the purchasing power concept. Otherwise, it becomes quite meaningless. If you actually were to translate those numbers back into the numbers which are based on the actual market exchange rates that happen to exist in the world today, that 10 to 1 figure would be 50 to 1. Would mean that the average person in India, shall we say, had 1/50th of the income of the average person in the United States, in which case they'd obviously be dead. So the figure is meaningless. So it's only the PPP figures that have any meaning, and this is recognized by the United Nations Human Development Report in all their statistics concerning poverty in particular countries. However, unfortunately, when they make general statements about the way the world income distribution is moving and where it's moving between countries, for reasons that I do not know, they are prone to use the other kind of data, which I regard as misleading.
But 2 minutes, right?
Right, that's fine. Now, my idea is that it is possible to eliminate all absolute poverty in the world by the year 2050, and to eliminate all relative deprivation, as I have defined it, by the end of the century. That means that the average standard of living in the first world and the third world will be equal by the end of the century. We wouldn't have any two worlds anymore. And I am arguing, shockingly to many people, that this is technically and financially and economically feasible. In the first world, what it means essentially is having permanent full employment in order to get rid of that 10% of people who are below the $15 a day line. And I'm very pleased that George Brown has now been converted to this idea. I'm worried about the future of the director of London School of Economics. Oh, Gordon Brown. I'm sorry, I'm so old that these things keep happening to me. It's terrible. I'm worried about the director of the London School of Economics, who's a good friend of mine, because he wrote a book not long ago saying that the idea of full employment was dead, and at one time it seemed to be that the new Labour government was endorsing that. But I'm glad to say that as a result of all these books we've all written, that's changed. Secondly, we must do something somehow, and I think it will happen, to restore, as it were, a kind of normality, is hardly the word, to the transitional economies. There's been a collapse of government which has led effectively to a collapse of general production, and that has caused an enormous increase in poverty. Finally, in the third world, which is what we're all concerned about, there has to be a general takeoff into sustained growth of income per head, of real income per head. It's got to be at about 4% per annum for about 100 years. And if we did that, there would be complete convergence, because I think that the first world will slow down to about 1%. Now, since the population of the third world is going to slow down to about 1.5% or less, this means we're talking about total growth rates of total GDP of between 5 and 6%. And this means it has to go year after year after year. It sounds very, very high. But actually, it's already happening. It's been happening in East Asia for the last 20 years, and the figures for recent years in India are comparable with that, and in many other parts of the world. This takeoff is happening, and I am arguing in my book that what we need to sustain it is on progressive culture. I liked Tony Blair's speech very much on the topic of what the word progressive means. Progressive cultures, education, 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 essentially. Finish, 1 minute?
30 seconds.
30 seconds, primary education for women. And finally, effective government. Government which actually can make things happen, preferably as democratic as possible. But what's more important is that if it says it would like to have more primary education, it gets around to actually doing it. And if you like, I mean, I've got a lot of other points we can make on this, but for the moment, I can end there, as I should do, and simply say that in my book, I have argued that in various ways I claim that this is feasible. I claim that the enormous environmental questions, world GDP would have to multiply by a factor of 30 by the end of the century. The enormous environmental questions, if you take them to pieces and look at them technically, they are technically manageable, etc., etc., and many other things along those lines. And as far as I'm concerned, as a human race, if we wring our hands and say it's all impossible, we are basically abandoning the poor of the world.
So your solution is growth, and you don't believe that the targeting of debt relief is effective, appropriate? What's your one-line answer to that?
I think it's a red herring.
You think Jubilee 2000 is a red herring?
I didn't believe that until it was decided by the powers that be I should write something in The Guardian about it on Monday. So I got all the numbers from Jubilee Red Herring. Sorry. They kindly sent me all their figures, and when I studied them, I decided that the effect of this relief campaign was a total distortion. All the really big blocks of poor people in the world were completely left out of it, and that in that, I don't say it shouldn't be done. The debts aren't going to get paid anyway. But
okay. So you're a hardhead who believes the world GDP can increase by 30 times in the next 100 years and solve the poverty problem, and debt relief is a red herring.
Yes.
Okay. Just in case you weren't clear what his position is, that's his position. Now, speaker two, and I'm now going to be really tough about this. I gave Robin a flat indulge, Robin, but it really is 5 minutes. It's Tim Gorringe to reply.
Not only do I agree with Robin about eliminating world poverty, but the thing that I most like about the book is its egalitarian philosophy, and that I'm profoundly in agreement with. So 4 points of disagreement, and then 4 indicators of where I would like to see the movement to eliminate world poverty going. First, on the meaning of poverty, Robin doesn't take up Vandana Shiva's very important distinction between what she calls poverty as subsistence and misery as deprivation. Now, subsistence has a very negative word in our culture, but she argues that there are cultures which live sustainably which should not be regarded as poor, and that the transition to a commodity economy can destroy those economies and throw thousands of people into poverty and starvation, as happened in Ethiopia. Two, the one phrase in Robin's book which I find really chilling is the phrase rationalized agriculture. He tells us that we need rationalized agriculture. Now, I don't know what that means, whether it means Monsanto, agribusiness, Cargill.
It means getting 1.5 billion people out of agriculture and producing the same quantity of food.
Now,
order.
There's a huge argument within farming about whether large-scale farming is effective or whether small farms are not more productive. And I find myself firmly in the second camp. The arguments center around use of pesticides, soil erosion, declining genetic diversity, the control of seed patents, and so on. Third, growth in the third world. Well, great, but driven by whom and for what? And one problem that Robin doesn't really wrestle with is globalization. So in the whole growth scenario, one of the things that I find most worrying is the homogenizing effects of global growth when it's driven by the big TNCs. As we know, a new McDonald's is open somewhere in the world every 9 hours, and I don't find that at all an attractive prospect. Four, the question about whether growth, even though we're not talking about driving growth in the north, but in the south, whether it's actually sustainable. Robin is an optimist, and he feels that the ecological limits of our planet can cope with the growth that he outlines. I'm much more skeptical about that. If you look at the UN Environmental Programme report, which was published last month, they address the question, which Robin also looks at, as to whether there's enough water to go around, for example. Now, he feels that's not a problem. They put it at the very top of their list of problems. He says, look, this whole planet is constituted by water, it's awash with water. Actually, half of 1% is drinkable. Okay, my formula for eliminating poverty. First of all, give priority to the local over the global. That seems to me absolutely crucial. As John Maynard Keynes famously said 70 years ago, let goods be homespun. What are we doing when in our global economy, we, this country, export 50% of our butter and import 50% of what we use?
One more minute,
okay. Secondly, I'm wholly in agreement with Robin's proposals for regulating finance, but regulate trade and the transnational corporations as well. Third, education, of course, but education for sustainability and education to promote the self-esteem of peoples in the South. And lastly, it seems to me that in the whole growth question, there is an ethical bottom line. It seems to me that the problems of growth are bound up with the consumer economy, that the planet can't sustain the northern lifestyle for 6, 8, 10 billion people. That puts the onus on us to do something about it.
So you are a redistributionist and a freezer of living standards in the north at current levels.
Something like that.
Just to get it clear.
Yep.
Okay. Our third speaker is Lal Jeyawardena, who is going to use the microphone. I think that's very wise. Over to you.
Thank you. I would propose to confine myself to filling in certain areas where Robin's argument about the need for rapid economic growth in the developing world would need to be fleshed out. Specifically, I will be concerned with two things: the international constraints to rapid growth in developing countries set by today's environment, and second, with the domestic constraints to growth, what Robin calls his three keys. Now, on the first point, the problem that poor countries face in generating an East Asian-style takeoff in an environment of globalization is the challenge that Robin addresses in outline by calling for a reform of the IMF, but he does not quite specify how this should be done. Here the argument would, I think, need to be fleshed out. Let me particularize this problem with reference to my own country, Sri Lanka. We are now growing at 5% per annum in GDP terms and investing 25% of GDP, a capital output ratio to economists of 5-1. Now, if we are to do what East Asia has done, which is to grow at 8%, then we need to invest 40% of our GDP. This is a rate well within the range of East Asian achievement. Now, in order to achieve this, and this is our problem, we would need to eliminate an overall budget deficit of the order of 10% of GDP to boost national savings. And that means we need another 5% at least in terms of net foreign inflows to get to East Asian growth rates. So that's the challenge. Now, insofar as getting the budget deficit story done takes takes a number of years, then we would need more foreign inflows. Now, the point is that the maximum level of direct foreign investment in relation to GDP generated by countries in recent years is in the range 5-7% of GDP in Singapore and Chile respectively. So in practical terms, poor countries would need a combination of direct foreign investment and portfolio investment in order to generate the foreign savings needed for takeoff, unless aid is stepped up dramatically, which Robin calls for, but for which there seems little political appetite, except to focus available aid on the developing countries of Africa. Now, the problem really arises with the volatility of portfolio investment flows, as the recent East Asian crisis has demonstrated. The well-known herd instinct causes, associated with portfolio flows and short-term lending, causes a rush for the exits at the merest whiff of a crisis. And now in a regime of capital account convertibility, which is what we've had in East Asia, and floating exchange rates, this would and did precipitate exchange rate plunges and inflationary spirals, and of course massive poverty in those countries. Now, a controlled capital account, as in the case of India, China, and Sri Lanka, insulates the country against such a crisis at the expense, arguably, of foregoing some of the benefits of free capital inflows, although the proposition is a controversial one in the academic literature. At any rate, this kind of globalization risk can only be avoided, and the benefits of openness, which Robin talks about, maximized only by putting in place a credible lender of last resort facility, which requires a radically redesigned IMF with enormously greater lending capability than is the case today. Stan Fisher, the IMF's deputy managing director, has argued in a recent paper that if the IMF had expanded in line with world trade, it would be now about $2.5 trillion in size, in quarter size, instead of today's $300 billion. This would, of course, have materially enhanced the crisis lending capability of the IMF to countries on the scale needed to what I call stare down the speculator when they rush for the exits. In the absence of an IMF of this size, the world is reduced to cobbling together bits and pieces of finance to go to the aid essentially of systemically significant countries when they come under speculative attack, and even then invariably too little and too late. Others are left out in the cold. That's a real problem.
Another minute.
Well, I have some ideas about how we might proceed to build a better IMF, which I can talk about in the discussion. So I will pause here on that front. But if I have a minute on the domestic constraints to development, the point that I would like to make is simply this. I have no quarrel with Robin's three things: culture, education, and effective government. But I would regard these as necessary rather than sufficient conditions for takeoff. The mechanisms through which these ingredients operate are really the old-fashioned verities of development economics, which Robin mentions, but somewhat en passant. The point is that it is impossible for high growth to occur without high rates of domestic savings and high rates of investment, both domestic and foreign. And what has happened is, and I have the numbers here, East Asia has developed specific mechanisms for ensuring this, which South Asia hasn't. One can talk about what these specific mechanisms are in the course of the discussion. Thank you.
So the kind of one sentence summary of you, for you is that no growth without some change in international financial architecture, which is the precondition for anything.
Right.
It's now Mary Calder's 5 minutes, and they're doing better and better, our speakers.
Oh, gosh. Well, I want to make three quite separate points. The first point is about the debate between Robin Morris and Timothy Gorringe. They both agree about the desirability of ending poverty. They disagree about how you get there. I think a key point is that growth doesn't necessarily have to mean more consumption. Growth can mean more spending on environmental technologies, more spending on health, more spending on education. And it's the type of growth that's crucial. That's my first point. Second point, Robin Morris says key to all of his proposals is effective government. And one has sort of, when reading his book, one has the idea of some very clever person who's suddenly in government and who knows how to do it and who carries out the action plan. And one wonders, how does that person get there? Where does he come from? Where does effective government come from? And I'm a little bit nervous about effective government and this idea of this know-all person, because I think that was very much the experience, for example, of the Soviet Union during the last 50 years. And I think one somehow needs to find other mechanisms for deciding what kind of growth and what kind of policies. I think a crucial problem in this globalized era is actually we're having less government, not more government. And the question is, how do you reach a point where policies can be undertaken that will bring about social justice and greater spending on environmental health and so on? So a second point is, how do you reach effective government in this globalized era? The third point is about war, because that's the subject I write about. And I think war in this era is very much associated with poverty and with absence of effective government. In previous eras, war was associated with state building and very often with redistribution. If we think about the First and Second World Wars and even the wars of the 19th century, they were wars between states in which everybody was mobilized for the war effort, and because governments needed the support of people, they often introduced new forms of taxation and new forms of redistribution. What we see now is exactly the opposite. We see a situation in which production declines, tax revenue declines, the legitimacy of states decline, and you get a kind of war economy, which is the opposite of growth, in fact. It involves the transfer of assets from the poor to the fighting parties through various illegal means like loot and pillage. And that kind of war economy has a tendency to spread. It's spread through large parts of Eastern Europe and large parts of Africa. And that, to me, is one of the biggest barriers to the elimination of poverty. Indeed, it's contributing to poverty, and in a vicious circle, that poverty forces people to become criminals or fanatics, and that further contributes to war. So my final point, actually it's 4 points, Will, not three. My final point is about justice, because that relates. Timothy Gorringe talks in his book about the new dark ages and the obsession with consumption, but he also talks about the other side of the coin, that we do live in an era in which, for the first time, we regard human beings as equal, at least some of us do. And we have a belief in human rights, and that includes economic and social rights. And I think in an era where there is a lack of effective governance, then this emphasis on rights and a rights-based approach to eliminating poverty and to reaching different kinds of policies at a global level as well as at a local level is absolutely critical. And that's a struggle. It's a struggle between the Dark Ages, the people who are obsessed with selfish interests and consumption, and a new kind of notion of human equality.
I was trying to think of one line to kind of sum up what you just said, Mary. Actually, it doesn't come easily, but it's somewhere in the area of no war, good government.
Yeah.
George, who's just completing a book on East Africa called No Man's Land. Good title.
I feel one of the key questions that we've got to ask about poverty, of course, is how we measure it. And I feel that Robin's measurement, Robin's use of GDP as a measurement of poverty, unfortunately, is too crude. This is a measurement used, for example, by the World Bank. It measures poverty by the in terms of the absence of ready cash. And in order then to alleviate poverty, it liquidates natural capital to produce that ready cash. And this has had devastating impacts, both on the environment itself and, as a direct result of that, on the welfare of the very people whose poverty is supposed to be relieved. And in fact, what happens is that because their stock of natural capital, the resources on which they depend, can be massively depleted by these means, and at the same time, the natural capital is sequestered, not by them, but by big multinational or indeed national corporations, or for that matter, the state, then what you find is that people can become very much poorer indeed. They can be made poorer by efforts to boost GDP and to boost, in particular, GDP per head. It can have exactly the opposite problems to have exactly the opposite effects to the ones which are intended. And just as an indication of how crude a measure GDP is, the Paddington rail crash will probably be positive in terms of GDP. It's going to produce lots of work for consultants and for contractors. But no one would suggest that the Paddington rail crash was a positive contribution to the life of this country. I feel that Robin also errs in his rather glib assumptions about the compatibility of his development and growth model and environmental protection, the protection of environmental resources. In some cases he's glib, in some cases I'm afraid he's just plain wrong. He says we can sort out the fisheries problem, for example, through fish farming. Well, on fish farms all over the world, fish are fed on fish. And the result of fish farming is actually a massively increased harvest of wild fish rather than a decreased harvest. He says that we can sort out traffic jams by building more roads. Well, I'm afraid since 1938 we've known that building more roads actually increases congestion rather than relieving it. He says that the world can absorb more and more global tourism because it'll find more and more places for those tourists to go to without environmental effects. Well, already we have a situation where, depending on how you measure it, flights can cause between 5% and 15% of all carbon dioxide emissions, and it's emitted right up there in the stratosphere, so it can't be reincorporated into biological systems. It's a very significant contributing factor to global warming. And that there is a fundamental incompatibility between the development model which Robin advocates and conservation of resources. And that is simply that investors are looking for returns of 12 or 14%. Biological rates of return are some 3% and less in cold countries. And so inevitably, if you are going to, if you're not going to suffer significant opportunity costs, you have to exploit biological resources beyond the rates of return. And this accounts for a very interesting phenomenon. As Robin points out in his book, in the 1970s, there were various reports talking about the disappearance of certain raw materials, and they concentrated on things like oil and nickel and cadmium and copper and tin. In other words, all the non-renewable resources they said were going to disappear. Well, as Robin correctly points out, they haven't. In fact, the price of most of those resources has dropped. But what has been hit, strangely, is the renewable resources. What we've seen is a massive depletion in fresh water, in soil, in primary growth timber, in fisheries. And that's simply because the investment rate of return required necessarily outstrips the biological rates of return. So there is an incompatibility there which hasn't been sorted out.
One more minute.
Okay, I'll use this minute just very briefly to talk about debt. Lots of other things I'd like to talk about. But I feel that debt, far from being a red herring, is actually very important, not just because of the immediate impact it has on poverty relief, but also because of its enormous symbolic value. I think the idea that sub-Saharan Africa, for example, owes us a debt is as risible as it's pernicious. This is a part of the world which has suffered 100 years of Western-induced slavery and 200 years of resource stripping. And the idea that they owe us anything, I think, is frankly absurd. And to get rid of that debt gets rid of a major symbolic barrier to the idea that we can operate in such a way that we can strive towards global equality, which is surely what we're all talking about.
I think George's one line is pretty easy, really, and it's impossible is your line, isn't it? Claire.
I caution everyone to go down George's road, which is trying to sort out our abuse of the planet at the cost of the poorest in the world. One in four of us sharing this planet, there's now 6 billion of us, lives in abject poverty. The World Bank measure, we need statistics for certain purposes, as everybody understands, the dollar a day, that's the global way in which we measure it. But the realities are very low life expectancy, Sierra Leone 37, very high maternal mortality, high risk of dying every time a woman is pregnant and has a child, very high numbers of your children dying before they're one or before they're five. Lots of the children who survive being so malnourished that they are damaged physically and mentally. That's the kind of conditions we're talking about, and one in four of us is living in those conditions. Doesn't have clean water, no sanitation, no chance of education. Their children die of measles and simple illnesses that we know how to treat, but we're not bringing the resources of the world to a quarter of us. We live at a time of unprecedented knowledge, information, capital, engineering capacity. We have the capacity, if we want to do it, to rapidly bring development to this quarter of humanity who are living in conditions that no human being deserves. And in order to achieve that, we need economic growth. So please don't think we shouldn't be so materialistic. Of course we shouldn't. But then project that onto the poorest of the world, where for them being materialistic is having more to eat, having some health care, having some education for your children, and so on. This is the biggest moral imperative facing the world. And what is more, in our own self-interest, if we don't do better, the costs in terms of population growth, environmental degradation, war, refugees, diseases that we can't treat will come back and hit the next generation wherever they live. It's also the biggest political imperative of our times, but our political systems are so old-fashioned, they're on the agendas of yesterday within our nation states, by and large, and this is seen as a sort of charitable add-on to politics instead of the most central issue of how we're going to manage our globalizing economy. It isn't just Robin that thinks the levels of poverty reduction are possible. So does virtually every government in the world, the G7, the World Bank, the IMF, the UN system, or at a whole series of conferences, the world has voted for systematic poverty reduction by creating the conditions that attract inward investment. I mean, you might not like the idea of multinational companies, but that's where your pension fund is, that's where the technology of the world is, you are all enjoying the proceeds of it, and then people talk as though, keep your dirty capital out of Africa. Africa's problem is that multinational capital responsibly deployed isn't interested in being invested there. It brings all the possibilities of improved life with it. And with the right kind of good government, effective government, proper regulation of the banks, enforcement of contracts, and proper conditions for labor, for respect for labor standards, and respect for the environment, you can leverage the investment that brings you telecommunications, electricity, proper processing of water, sanitation, and all the things that people need to have a decent and civilized life. In the last 50 years, more human beings have climbed out of those conditions than in the previous 500 years of human history. The previous 500 years includes the time when the whole of Western Europe and North America climbed out of conditions of abject poverty. In 1849, in Birmingham, average life expectancy was 37. It was 26 in Liverpool. It was 40-something in Surrey. We had child labour, illiteracy, squalor, women dying in childbirth, and so on. And we climbed out of that condition through the wealth that was generated by industrialisation, then being used and shared to uplift all the people. Globalisation is generating masses of wealth. If we manage it right, we can uplift that quarter of humanity into being able to enjoy a basic human life. Then we can have the debate about not being too materialistic and so on. But please don't project our problems onto the poor of the world who simply deserve a decent life. On war, Mary is absolutely right. Of the 34 poorest countries in the world, 20 are in conflict or recently emerged from conflict. Now the Cold War's over and the permafrost that held everything, war is breaking out and is predominantly now within the poorest countries. And of course, it's very difficult to govern well in a very poor country, but once war breaks out, it entraps a country in continuing and growing poverty. And we have to do much more to prevent conflict, resolve it, and we could. And that's part of what's necessary in order to get the systematic development. The UN, 1 minute. The UN voted for all these targets that the OECD Development Committee agreed was possible. The halving of the proportion living in extreme poverty by 2015. Every child in the world into primary education. Then educating girls is profoundly developmental. It transforms society as they grow up. Basic healthcare systems for everybody. All experts agree these things are achievable. Since then, the G7 and at the recent meeting, the IMF and the World Bank, and we're getting some change there, have said they'll use these targets around the debt relief. So I think here the red herring has brought us major reform, Robin, in the IMF and what it's going to use to measure what is successful development. I haven't got enough time to go on, but believe you me, this is doable. If we don't do it, too many of us suffer. And the world is going to see major catastrophe in 20 to 50 years. And the pessimism that's in the environmental lobby and the people who just want to look at poverty and wring their hands are potentially missing an opportunity to see the biggest advance for more people that we've ever seen in human history. That is possible at this time because of the wealth that's being generated by globalization if we manage it well. Create the government conditions that can attract the inward investment, educate their people, provide healthcare, and drive up conditions for the poor of the world. And that we must do, and it's doable. And please support those endeavours. Thank you.
Well, I suppose Claire's one line is slightly third way speech, I thought, actually, Claire. Liking capitalism, wanting to reform it, and let's do it, but not the way the right would do it, of course. What about debt relief? Is that a red herring? Just 30 seconds on that before we throw it open.
It's not a red herring, but it's been exaggerated what it can do. There's 40 countries, very, very poor, with such high levels of debt that they'll never be able to pay it. And those high levels of debt are blocking them adopting the kind of policies they need to adopt to move their country forward. So clearing out that out of the way is a precondition for them. But there's a lot of other poor countries that haven't got debt and they've still got problems. And even when we clear that out of the way, it doesn't end all poverty. And the enthusiasm of the international campaign, which is wonderful and shows how much the world is moved by the issues of poverty internationally, almost led to the point of believing once we deal with the problem of debt, we've solved all our problems, and that is to exaggerate.
Okay, let's points, questions in the balcony immediately. Yeah.
One of the points about effective governance is democratic accountability and participation. That's the way which we get effective governance, and through which policies are refined and improved and challenged. And many problems need to be tackled at a global level, like climate change, the financial institutions that have been mentioned, poverty reduction and redistribution. And the importance, so I want to bring in the point about the importance of effective, accountable and equitable global governance. I'd just like to mention in passing that on the 24th of October in The Observer will be published a full-page Charter 99 calling for accountable governance. So I hope you will support that, and I hope be interested in your views on the importance of improving, reforming. democratic, global, accountable, global governance to tackle the issues of poverty reduction. Thank you.
I have to write a leader back again. I can see that. Other points? Sir, yeah.
I'm a Ugandan. I live on both worlds. So when people call poverty, I know what it means. I've seen people who have not eaten for weeks and months and have died because of lack of food. Here to make a critique or to commend, but I'm here to say one of the biggest problems seems to me as a political scientist is lack of good governance. Because if you look at Uganda in the 1960s, or even during colonial period, in spite of what we call massive exploitation of the resources by the colonial power, by then the British, there was, seems to have been some sense of law and order. From 1971, it has never been the same in that country called Uganda. It is true, multinational corporation, the World Bank, have a very unfair trading system, which unfair system is being practiced on third world countries. So I would also say, much as we want to eradicate poverty in third world, that fair trading system between the north and the south, where the south are just producer and also consumer of manufactured goods from the west, should be addressed. The insecurity.
15 more seconds, okay. Yeah,
the insecurity which is now rampant in Africa is a result of a global arms trade. And to the producer of that arms trade are the multinational company in the West, including the former Soviet Union. We'll never solve African poverty until there is law and order and government become responsible to stop the globalization of small arms, which is now the necessity of few people and many people in Africa. Thank you.
Let's see if there's anyone. We'll just take this point here. Down here.
This is short and sweet. This is to Robin. According to the World Wide Fund for Nature, 30% of the Earth's natural wealth in terms of forests, freshwater, marine resources have been destroyed since 1970. According to your scenario for growth, how long can this continue without disaster striking us?
Okay, one more question. Is it an environmental question? An environmental question?
That was
already another one. Another one to follow that. Okay, go on.
Not strictly environmental.
But a good question nonetheless, no doubt. Go on.
Jim Kennedy, regarding the issue of water, in the overall statement of the aim of the world plan to end poverty, reference is made to the issue of safe water. I think it's very unrealistic to give insufficient attention to the technological aspect. That of that proposed 5% covenanted levy around the world, it's not going to be realistic to achieve the increase in or the elimination of unsafe drinking water unless one addresses the issues of developing new sources of water and reducing the levels of consumption so as to achieve sustainable levels. Many experts believe that in certain regions of the world, the next conflict, if not all-out major war, is going to be over the issue of water.
Okay. Actually, there's a very interesting report in today's International Herald Tribune making just that point and citing China and India. For those who don't read the Trib, it's worth while for that report alone. I think we should open this up a bit just, Robin, there you are. You've argued for a world GDP growing by 30 times 4% growth for 100 years for LDCs. And actually, I mean, George got clapped, and the questions from the audience are saying, come on, it's impossibilist. You know, you just are not being real about the environmental constraint.
Shall I concentrate on water? Let's stick to one environmental point. There are many of them. My plan doesn't require us to consume 30 times more water. If you work it out, it would be about a doubling. The total amount of water on the planet is constant. It cannot be destroyed. It's an indestructible substance. It goes round and round and round. It goes up into the air, comes down again, and round and round. We divert a fraction of it for our own use. We divert something like, is it one part in something of a million or something? And all that would have to happen is it would become two parts in a million. That process of diversion involves waterworks, money, expenditure on those kind of structures. In the first world, that's all been done. And in order to do it in the third world, you just have to spend that money as part of the process of growth. As far as the water being safe is concerned, as against adequate in quantity, the fundamental cause of unsafe water is inadequate sewage. And therefore, what is necessary is to do what we did here in the Victorian period, is to build adequate sewage plants and pipes and things like that. It does cost money. I tried to cost it. I don't know whether I was right, because I can't find any of these figures anywhere in this amazing literature. No, all the people who wring their hands about the unsafe water, I haven't seen one study of how much it would cost to put it right. Now, the other question, I think that's enough. I mean, this question about...
Okay, let's get George. George, I mean, when you said, we all know that building roads is no answer, and...
Oh, by the way, I said nothing about building more roads.
Yeah, but yes, I mean, you did actually, Robin. No, it's in Chapter 8. Have a look.
Well, can I...
Hold on a minute, Claire. I just look at...
We've got rural roads. Listen, the people who... The subsistence farmers whose children are hungry and who don't produce any more than they can immediately consume is because they can't get anything to market and earn anything. Mm-hmm. Rural roads that they build and maintain are key to them being able to just get beyond subsistence, increase their livelihood, get their children to school and get to some health care. Some roads are entirely progressive.
Yes, no, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. What Robin claims in Chapter 8, as I'm sure he's about to discover, is that in the first world, building roads will relieve congestion. That was my point there. Robin, you'll find it there. I read it on the bus on the way up.
Let me arbitrate between here and
reasons. Go on, George.
Right.
Continue.
No. Well, there are two points I'd like to come on to here. One is water, there's some major problems to do with water which aren't just to do with the pollution of water, clearly, but are also to do with the loss of watersheds. And this is involved, of course, in the felling of primary forest, compaction of soil, all the rest of it. The hydrological systems simply don't function. So we have to look at water in a much broader, more holistic sense if we're going to do anything about this at all. And already, I'm afraid, many parts of the world are desperately water-stressed, and this is in terms of absolute precipitation. So it's very hard to see how they can double their water. In fact, it's very hard to see how they can maintain their existing water use. And one of the most wasteful uses of water, of course, is irrigation around the world, and this has caused far more water problems than it's actually solved. I just want to respond also to Titus's point about global governance. At the moment, the models of global governance which are being thrown at us, I feel, are completely counterproductive. We saw the multilateral agreement on investment, which, thank goodness, was stopped dead quite recently, but certain ideas which were promulgated by the OECD and the other sponsor countries are basically allowing corporations to sue governments with no countersuit measures at all to remove any regulations that they wanted, environmental regulations, social regulations, workplace regulations, the rest of it, consumer, all the rest. Okay. We're going to see some of that incorporated possibly into negotiations at Seattle. And we've seen very recently United States Senate has passed the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is effectively saying we will give you no terms of trade, no debt relief, no aid, nothing at all, unless you privatize your entire state sector and let us, our American corporations, in. That's exactly the sort of global governance we don't need.
Yes, the offending sentence in the Chapter 8, for the, third way Delphic judgment here. Robin writes, traffic congestion has a tendency to resolve itself either by road construction, reconstruction, or in the absence of either, by the simple fact that when it becomes bad enough, people travel elsewhere or less.
Quite an advocacy of road building.
It's not quite an advocacy of road building, but not quite an advocacy of not road building either, I think. Okay, we continue. Yes.
Can I say something?
Well,
on
just a question from the audience. Just a couple more questions, then we'll come back to you.
My name is Niall Lawless. I'm a consulting engineer. One of the things that worries me is our sense of smugness, which comes from a Western scientific perspective, which is that we can actually control water, where it is, its availability. Even in this country, where we're supposed to be sophisticated, almost year on year or every several years, we go through a process where we don't have enough water. And you know, when you take countries, we're surrounded by water. You take countries like India, China, mass land masses, no water. You know, the prospects are really, really scary. You know, there is complete chaos out there which we can't control. And we seem to be sitting here thinking, well, maybe we can control it.
I'd love to see a woman putting up her hand actually ask a question, but women don't tend to on these kind of occasions, daunted by so many Ah, oh, there's one. Good.
There's one of them.
This is to Robin Morris. You seem very optimistic, but from my perspective as a younger person, it seems that in about 20 years, Europe, with its negative population growth, will be groaning under the social service expenses of their aging population. The mass of retirees will have to be supported by a small group of workers, such as myself, who will be groaning under the tax burners. Thank you.
Okay, well, hold on to that for a minute, Robin. Let's a couple more, and then we'll back to the... Great. Yeah. Yeah, just down there.
Very quickly, I didn't hear anything, a discussion about two issues. One, population, which sort of is related to what you're talking about, and controls and concerns that are expressed about birth control, et cetera. And the second is that with discussion about multinationals or transnationals or however you want to call them, it seems to be a very traditional view of they setting the rules and coming in without any discussion about sort of cross-sectoral kinds of collaborations that would be a different way among governments, not-for-profit sector, and MNCs actually cooperating, where none of them actually sets the rules, but collectively perhaps they set some rules.
Okay, well, yeah, there's a chap behind, is it? Not you, but the chap there, yeah.
Commonwealth Secretary.
John Coquel in the Conflict Analysis Unit at the LSE. I wonder if the panel could address the problem that if growth is achieved the way that it was during industrialization in the middle of the 19th century, in the other three-fifths of the world where you don't have those levels of growth, what does this mean for the environmental carrying capacity of the planet? If there could be a little bit more discussion of that, I think that would shed some light on some of the dilemmas involved in those that type of growth. The other thing that I just wanted to say is about the nature of conflict. Violent conflict, or if you want to think of it that way, is not caused by resource scarcity, and it is not caused by poverty. It's much more important to think about conflict, first of all, in multi-causal terms. Conflicts are not caused by any single cause, but it has much more to do with malgovernance, and it fits in well with comments that other people have been making about the importance of devolving governance down to more regional and local levels. It's malgovernance that drives violent conflict, not poverty, and the sooner that we start blocking these kinds of arguments that conflicts are monocausal or that they're driven by poverty, the sooner we'll begin to be able to deal effectively with them in policy terms.
Thank you. And then just next door here, there, yeah, chap in front of you.
S.K. Rao from India. You know, when we discuss poverty, I think it's very easy to be very pessimistic. And I think one of the great merits of Robin's book is that he has actually shown that a number of people have climbed out of poverty. I think as Claire Short was saying, that in the last 5 decades, many more people have actually become, have managed to climb out of poverty than in the last 500 years. And we need to recognize these achievements. It's not as if things are going horribly wrong all the time. Things are improving. And I think we need to congratulate that success and see in what way we can help. And in that context, I want to ask two questions. Both of them are addressed to Claire Short. One is that, you know, we say that attract investment, trade more, use market opportunities. But we actually see that when it comes to the crunch, industrial countries are not prepared to accept the level of imports or exports which developing countries can export, you know, in the areas where they have comparative advantage. We have restrictions on agriculture, on export of textiles, on export of garments. So we talk about poverty here, giving the impression that we are hugely sympathetic to elimination of poverty, but we don't actually do take steps where it can help people. And the second question I wanted to ask is, you know, question of good governance. We know that some countries and some states are doing very well in terms of promoting growth as well as eliminating poverty. Are we sure that the donor countries are actually giving the weight they require, I mean, you know, are giving priority to giving aid to those countries who are performing well? Why do countries shy away from giving more help and aid to those countries which are doing well and be much more brutal in terms of regimes which are not spending money well? These are the two questions I wanted to ask.
And again, I'll get Claire to pick up that point, but I just want to ask Mary Caldor and the three of our panel who haven't spoken yet about this good governance question which is emerging. I mean, you want good governance, Mary? Tell us how you're going to get it.
First of all, on the point about wars, I think wars are caused by politics. And very often in the wars that we've seen in recent years, the politics have to do with exclusive claims to the state, which you could call malgovernance. It's a situation where people want to control the state for their own little group and exclude others. So, and that often arises in situations of poverty, though I agree with you, the cause isn't poverty, it arises in situations of shortage. That's the first point. Second point on good governance, Titus Alexander said what we need is democracy and accountability. And of course, I'd be the first to agree with that. But above all, what I think is we need not just democratic institutions, but democratic politics. We need a politics that emphasizes the need for government not just for exclusive groups, governments not just the preserve of particular cliques, governance for people, multiculturalism, tolerance, economic and social justice, those issues. So I think politics is really the heart of it as much as governance per se. And I think a lot of the emphasis on effective governance actually doesn't take into account the importance of politics. And then one final point. I think one of the big problems today at a local level is that if you're subsistence farmer in India, your life is being influenced by decisions that are being taken thousands of miles away. And that makes democracy very difficult. And it seems to me that when we're talking about good governance or changing or democracy, the problem is less the accountability of global institutions, but how to give the small farmer some kind of access, how to create a situation in which in his or her local situation they can actually influence what happens. And that seems to me an absolutely crucial problem of effective governance, because I think there isn't one set of knowledge, and that's what we learned from the experience of totalitarianism. There's a lot of knowledge in people's experiences, and the question is how do you tap that for government?
Lana, you were going to say something about the IMF and reform of the IMF in the kind of international good governance. What are you going to, I mean, how do you get it?
Sorry, I missed that.
You were talking about reform of the IMF, and you were going to say a few words in the question and answer session. How are you going to get international good governance? And in particular, what are your reform proposals? What are your reform proposals for the IMF? You have a minute and a half.
Yes. Well, very specifically, you very difficult to get quota increases, but you can equip the IMF to create special drawing rights to itself, which it can then disperse to countries in trouble very fast, without cobbling together bits and pieces of money. And the and these SDRs can be extinguished after use so that there is no kind of permanent inflationary overhang, unlike the usual kind of SDR. And then the deal that the developing countries can offer as a quid pro quo is to give the IMF some sort of a mandate on the capital account. That is to say, if a country wants to intensify capital account restrictions like India or Sri Lanka, it has to talk to the IMF and have a consultation with them. So if there's a deal of this kind, then you can have a situation where developing countries can gradually liberalize their capital accounts at their own pace and reap the full benefits of openness, pari passu with strengthening their domestic financial systems, which is where the crisis hit East Asia. They had convertibility on the capital account and floating exchange rates, but very weak banking and financial sectors. So if you have a more gradual process of the kind that I'm advocating, backed by a lender of last resort facility, which is vital for countries to take that risk, then you can have a world which creates a climate for growth and reaps the benefits of openness. That's the design.
But we have two leading American presidential candidates talking about the abolition of the IMF, and the US Senate and Banking Committee starting hearings about, again, the abolition of the IMF. I mean, I just think, you know...
We need to send aid for good governance to the United States.
I mean the discourse in which, you know, we're discussing here how you might improve or reform the IMF and how one might penalize or reward good governance or, you know, really get hold of the international arms trade is a context in which, you know, the American Senate are not ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and talking about abolishing the IMF. You know, there is a kind of, because that's why it's in that context I put this question. I mean, you know, in hard real politics, what's the coalition to be constructed? What pressure can be brought to bear? I mean, I just think that, you know, everyone should carry it in the back of their minds, really. Tim, yeah. I'll give you a word, and then I want to talk. There's a couple more people want to say.
I mean, on good governance, it just seems to me that you're not talking first of all about elites and what they do, but you're talking first of all about the mobilization of people's groups. And if you look at India, for example, then I would say good governance begins with Pinuri Meyakam, which is the women's movement in Tamil Nadu, the Karnataka farmers movement, the Chipko movement, movements like this, which are actually seeking to build democratically accountable politics in their regions, and that's where I want to start.
Okay, there's a couple points here, and I want to give Claire Shorter. Yeah, I've been very keen to speak for a long time.
Thank you. John Garrett from Jubilee 2000. So I wanted to raise the issue of debt again and disagree with Robin that it's actually a red herring. Because firstly, in terms of the 50 or so countries that we're arguing are in urgent need of debt relief, there a billion people actually live in those countries. And many of them are amongst the least developed countries, with 40 or 50% of the population living on less than $1 a day. And yet their governments, on average, are spending over 30% of their government revenue on servicing debt. And for some of those countries, it's even higher. So in the case of Madagascar, it's 60%. Nicaragua and Honduras were also about 50% of government revenue was being used in servicing debt. Now, in your book, you actually argue that one of the key things that is necessary is for a ratcheting up of net official aid, i.e. the gross amount less actual repayments. Now, I mean, I think one of the real strengths of Jubilee 2000 is that they've actually managed to point out that the amount of debt repayment for developing countries is something like 8 or 9 times more than they're actually receiving in aid. And although it's less than that for the 50 or so countries, many of them are actually paying more in debt service than they are paying in aid. And the final point is that you're arguing that you can eradicate poverty in 100 years. Jubilee 2000 is actually saying that you can take an act in the next few months, which is going to make a very real difference to people. Because essentially, as Keynes said, we're all dead in the long run. There's many people who are going to die over the period of the next 100 years. But in fact, an act in the year 2000 could actually bring benefits immediately to many of the people in the poorest countries.
Thank you. You can have a minute at the end. There's a up there, and there's a up there, and we'll call it all. So just there, and then here, so in the center. Pass the mic along.
Shout.
I have to get up and shout.
Regarding the question of debt, what is the best way to
interesting to hear moral hazard about debt relief, about debt cancellation, but yeah. And there's a point here in the center. You might actually give up on the mic and just shout. Okay, there's a at the back here, and then we'll wind it up and give the panel a final right of reply.
Yes, I'm a second year economics student at Dulwich College. I'd like to ask the panel if they think that the use of tradable pollution permits would be an effective way to reduce worldwide pollution.
I know George Monbiot has strong views on that. Right, we'll get the panel to give a minute each, and then Claire, I think, should have a. You know, there's some points directed at Claire which she should speak to, and then we should break. So, and we'll do it in the same order, I think, that we all spoke in. So, Robin, it's your go first.
I've got to be very selective. There are so many things I would wish to answer. One of my greatest difficulties in a debate like this is that you can't come back. The number of statistics that have been thrown at me in this debate, which I happen to know to be totally wrong numerically, and I haven't got time to deal with it, but you're recently in my mind. You were very, very kindly sent me an Excel worksheet with all your numbers on it. And the figure I came up with for the number of people in your countries, 52 countries, which are below the $1 a day line, is 200 million. I don't know where your
it's
billion...
It's not a billion. It's not a billion.
I mean, I don't know where that comes from, on your own data sheet. Now, the same thing happened somewhere else over here, and I can't remember what it... Oh, dear, never mind. But
Gini coefficients up there.
Ah, Gini coefficients, right. If you want to know the Gini coefficient of any country in the world, you can go into the World Bank website, and there's a thing called the Denninger and Soir database of Gini coefficients. So I have a great many of these numbers in my head. There is only one country in Latin America that's got a Gini coefficient at that level. The Gini coefficient of India is about 0.4. It's rather similar to the UK. And the Gini coefficient of China is better than that. Now, we're talking about billions and billions of people here. And finally, I think what I'm going to say is I find in this debate that I'm always being faced with somebody saying, now, for example, in this country, and the country always turns out to be some miserably run Latin American country, or in an island in the Caribbean, or one of these very unfortunate war-torn countries of Africa. And that's all. I mean, there's so much more one could say about all of this. I have the question that I don't like the word governance. Why can't we call it government? It's administration. It's getting things done. Now, we all believe it's lovely and right that it should be democratic. We just say that. There is a very, very nasty and worrying thought about the role of liberal democracy in this whole situation, which really upsets me at times. The most successful poverty-reducing country in the world in the last 25 years has been China. China is a country with a large increase in her absolute population and an absolute decline in her poverty population. No other country has achieved that. Now, China is not a liberal democracy, but it has an effective government. I'm not saying it's a nice government, but it's effective. It's not like the Soviet Union. Now, we also know very, very undemocratic countries, such as Uganda at a certain period, where things were horrible. Now you have quite a democratic, very effective government, and economic growth in your country now, I believe, and poverty reduction, has taken off. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Where is it? Where's the chart? No? God, that's terrible, isn't it?
Okay, we'll stop. Last spring, Robin got very exercised by the figures for average earnings growth in Britain, and he said that the numbers are completely inflated by bonuses, the banking is completely wrong to put up short-term interest rates, and he was proved right. and there was a certain amount of egg on the bank's face, correct? Yeah. Anyway, I just think there should be, so Robin on his numbers is quite a good subject. He has one or two. He has one or two scalps under his belt. Tim.
Just 2 points. First, to be concerned about the environment isn't to wring your hands about ending poverty. It's perfectly possible to be passionately concerned for the environment and to be equally committed to ending poverty. That's the first thing. Second, the question of TNCs. As we know, the top dozen of these have turnovers which are greater than those of many nation states. Now, on Saturday, John Prescott announced that the government was considering taking away the responsibility for safety from Railtrack on the grounds that there was a conflict of interest between safety and profit. And that conflict of interest exists in TNCs between their concern for the environment and making their profits. It seems to me that given their role in the global economy, there have to be very effective ways of controlling them, bringing them under democratic responsibility.
Thank you. Now.
Well, can I make my point about international financial architecture slightly differently, if I may? Developing countries need foreign savings for takeoff. They can't do it without it. Domestic savings will not do the trick. One, you can't get enough foreign investment. Two, you won't get the aid, in spite of what Robin has been saying. It will be spread around thinly. So therefore, you need portfolio flows. And the only way you can get portfolio flows is pension funds try to diversify their holdings is through something like a lender of last resort facility. Otherwise, we'll not get that. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
George. No, Mary. It's then George.
Okay. And you have to go around one. Well, first, a point I wanted to make way back, because nobody answered the question of the lady in the front. I'm not going to talk about population, actually, because that's the expertise of other people on the panel. But I think there is an issue nowadays about multinational companies. That who are the motor of globalization? And my feeling is that a lot of multinational companies, it's a little bit like 19th century capitalism, are discovering that it is actually quite a problem operating in a deregulated world and a world where there isn't, if you like, a civil society in the sense of a rule of law. And they're getting into all kinds of difficulties, no doubt, in large part due to the activities of NGOs like Greenpeace. So I think there's a really interesting issue to be followed up, debates with multinational companies about social responsibility and about their role in promoting a global rule of law and a global development. So I think that's a really interesting new issue, actually, to be pursued. Secondly, just what do we need to do, summarizing, for good governance and poverty reduction? I mean, I think, first of all, we do need, it, because of globalization, the distinction between your rule of law at home and the absence of a rule of law abroad doesn't make sense. We do have all kinds of global regulations, and we need to strengthen that enormously, and we need to make the regime of human rights, which does exist and includes economic and social rights, something that is real and enforceable. That seems to me a first priority, and that has all kinds of implications for ending wars, for international policing and things which I won't go into. To get that, I think a second priority is that we do need a kind of global democratic politics.
Okay. George, I think we should move on.
And thirdly, just to say, in answer to Simon Maxwell, I think there needs to be a huge increase in global redistribution.
Okay, we'll agree on that. George.
Right, well, on the subject of carbon trading, I feel it's got some things going for it, as long as, one, it's very strongly ratcheted. In other words, the total pool is progressively reduced. And two, it's accompanied by a fully hypothecated energy tax. Anyway, sorry, technical answer to that. The second thing, which I'd like to end on, is that we hear all the time permanent calls from just about every quarter for deregulation. And in fact, even from our so-called better regulation unit, we keep hearing it talking not about better regulation, but about deregulation. And what deregulation, I'm afraid, often amounts to in economic terms is externalization. Companies can basically dump the costs which they should carry onto society as a whole. What regulation, if it's correctly applied, what regulation entails is internalization. Companies should carry the costs which they incur, costs to environment, costs in terms of social welfare and the rest of it. And I would like to see really the opposite process to what's taking place and what will be pushed for very hard at Seattle, which is a far better international regulatory regime rather than the international deregulatory regime which so many people are calling for.
And finally, Claire Short. And you've got some points to reply to from India.
Yes. I mean, the first thing I want to say really strongly is the pessimism that is around is totally destructive. What is possible in terms of the uplift of the poor of humanity needs people like you who care about these questions to see where the optimistic agenda is and demand the changes that drive it. But if people turn, you know, get into this very, very cynical, pessimistic mood, the chances of us achieving it are less. I mean, I found this meeting very unsatisfactory. It's just because there's so many of us, and therefore we haven't been able to properly answer the points. I think we've all got that frustration. There might be a lesson for some other time. Secondly, good governance. We and the World Bank, for its 2000 report, have been doing what's called participative poverty assessments around the world, asking the very poorest of the world what their priorities are. This is the human rights-based approach to development. Don't do it to the poor. They're very wise people. They know an awful lot of things. Talk to them about what enhances and improves their life. And they put, as our Uganda friend said, order, law and order, top. These are hungry people. But you can't even keep a chicken if there's gangsters around and they can take everything you've got. And without some sort of order, you cannot develop your life. And it's the top priority of the poor of the world is some kind of state that works, that brings some stability and order, that means you can grow your crops, sell something, get some schools for your children, and so on. So good governance is absolutely key, both to have healthcare and education, and the kind of regulation and enforcement of law and setting of standards that attracts the inward investment that's beneficial. And effective states are absolutely key, but we've got more democracy in the world than we've ever had before in human history. We are making advances, and we can go further, but some of the countries in Africa that we're working with have government systems that are so weak, civil servants that are so badly paid that you can't live on that money, therefore everyone's taking minor bribes and is distracted and doing other jobs. If you take the Congo, the old Zaire, it's as big as Western Europe. There's no state there. We have to help the people to build the basic infrastructure of a state if they're to be able to have healthcare, education, or any kind of economic growth, or any markets for people to sell their produce in. So good governance is key. We are making progress. We've got more respect for human rights and more democracy than we've ever had in human history. On the environment, we will not protect the environment better with the levels of poverty we have. The very poor of the world are destroying the rainforests because they have no options. They go and chop down the trees for their fuel, and for the land, it's useless land, it's soon exhausted, but if you have no choice, that's what you do. And the kind of forestry work we do now is to empower the poor people who live in the forest to control its future. They then start conserving it. But where do you see spreading deserts, destroyed rainforests, overfished seas, environmental degradation? It's where there's desperate poverty, very high population growth because people don't know that their children will live, have no access to contraception and so on. So you cannot look after the environment. We can't reverse the loss of environmental resources without improving the lives of people, the poorest people of the world, so that their children can be educated, they have less children when they know their children will live. You give them the power to look after their rainforest and to have sustainable economic development. And you can't, I mean, the poorest countries think that all of our concern for the environment is our determination to pull the ladder up after us. 80% of the pollution in the world is us, and now they think we want to regulate them to stop them growing. And if we don't do better than that, they will not agree to international standards that improve the environment. We've got to have a guarantee of their development within a world system that protects the environment. And that's the only way it will stick together, otherwise we've had it. And any suggestion of environmental standards in Seattle in the trade talks, they'll oppose.
And the majority of members of the World Trade Organization are now developing countries. Our friend from India is absolutely right. The international trading system is a disgrace. Africa can send out coffee or unprocessed cashew. The minute it processes it to get more value added for the continent, it hits our tariffs. That's why all those who say we don't need a new trade round, and that there's a really unholy alliance of protectionists, but environmentalists, people who claim to care about development, saying, let's not have any change in the trade rules of the world. Let's narrow what's taken at Seattle. The poorest countries need fairer trade rules in order to be able to both attract the inward investment and then export in order to pay for it. And we can do that responsibly and must. Population. It's very clear now with the Bangladeshis, there's all sorts of countries. If you educate little girls and you give people, by choice, access to contraception, the growth in population declines. The UN has just brought down its projection of where we're going to. It'll be 8.5 billion people by halfway through the next century, and then it should be stable if we spread education and give people choice. If we don't, it will go on escalating with all the degradation and conflict that comes from it. Multinational companies, Mary's absolutely right, they increasingly want regulation. The rawness of the competition of globalization is getting to them, the conflict with consumer movements and ethical consumer movements. So increasingly, multinational capital, and please remember, the seats you're sitting on, the clothes you're wearing, the cars you have, the fridges you have at home, the televisions, the radios, everything you use that makes your life comfortable is produced by multinational capital. Please don't think you're against it, therefore Africa can't have these things. It's where we have our technology and our capital. Of course we must regulate it, but it is increasingly interested in a regulated international environment. And if we can use that impulse to get worldwide rules that help to lift people up with responsible investment, we could make a great big advance. So on trade, I agree with you, and there's a chance at Seattle. If the developing countries will agree together what they want out of the next round, they can dominate it. The trouble is, there's so many people who are suspicious, there's a danger that they don't dominate the next round, and that's what I think we need to achieve at Seattle. On your second question was, are the donors giving aid to good performers? This is key. The World Bank's done a big assessment of where aid has been effective, and it's behind governments that are reformers. And when you've got the governments that have the guts to put in place what's needed, big resource transfers massively speed up their development. Behind a lousy, corrupt government, it's completely wasted. Now, of course, in the days of the Cold War, Mobutu got lots of aid, and everyone knew he was a corrupt kleptocrat. One of the advantages of the Cold War being over is that we can put resources behind the reformers, get models of success that will spread and bring other countries up. You can help badly governed countries to put in place the reforms, but they shouldn't have the resource transfers until those reforms are in place and they produce the results and the change. On income distribution, Simon, all very poor countries throughout history have been very unequal. Sub-Saharan Africa is very, very, very unequal. But usually in the course of development, the poor are lifted up and inequality reduces. There is no doubt, and it isn't redistribution. I mean, you cannot lift up the poor of the world by redistributing money from Europe. Yes, technology, yes, aid, yes, some help, yes, investments, but there isn't enough there. We've got to generate the economic growth in those countries to get the numbers of people up who need to come up. But how speedily economic growth reduces poverty depends on the degree of inequality. In a very unequal country, the poor get out of growth only in proportion to their original share. So if you can over time reduce inequality, then economic growth much more speedily reduces poverty. So it's a very, very important question. And actually, some of Latin America's failure is that it failed to achieve that. And it's a continent that should be very wealthy is carrying this tale of poor people that they suffer, but it holds back their own development. Sorry, Will, I finished, but believe you me, the biggest advance for most people that humanity's ever made is possible. Please get behind the positive agenda and reforming our international institutions in a way that they will perform for the people of the world and that our capital, our knowledge is used to benefit people. Instead of going into this knee-jerk, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank, multinational capital, and then the poor will continue to suffer and we'll have all sorts of crises for all of us. Thank you.
Okay, it's over, and thank you all. It was very enjoyable, very interesting. Good night, reception. Goodbye.
Hey, what about this reception?
Oh, hold on a minute, hold on a minute. Hold on a minute at the top.
Hold on a minute, because Candy Hudson would like to invite you to a reception on the fifth floor of this building. One of the problems is that the elevators are rather small, and that some of you, the more able, should be able to walk up, perhaps after sitting through this debate, you'll be able to manage. But we have drinks for you up there, and you'll be able to...
Okay, free drinks on the fifth floor.
Free drinks on the fifth floor.